Okay, we are going to open up our public informational hearing here in a minute. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee for the Senate. And I'm just going to go over the agenda for folks who are here to testify on bills. Unfortunately, we're still waiting for some paperwork on a few bills, so we're going to kick off the Environment and Natural Resources meeting today with an informational meeting on energy. And we have several bills on energy. Wanted to do the Energy 101 first, and then we're going to do some public hearings and we'll do some work sessions. So we're just waiting for paperwork on a couple of the work sessions, and hopefully we'll have that by the end of our meeting today. So with that, I will open up an informational meeting. This is invited testimony only, partially because of timing. We do have two new members. One of our new members will be appearing any moment here, but we wanted to provide an overview on energy. And we have about 40 minutes or so for that, so hopefully there'll be enough time. I listened to the energy budget all afternoon for the past 3 days, or has it been 3 days? Yes, it has. And so this is exciting to have the Department of Energy in front of us talking about sort of the basics, and especially for the new members, there will be a quiz afterwards, so please listen up. With that, I'll invite up Lisa Schwartz, who's the director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and Jason Eisdorfer, who is with the Public Utility Commission, and welcome, both of you. I think we're going to have some presentations, and Jennifer, during the presentations, we can ask you to turn down the lights a little bit. It's a little easier for us to see here at the dais. So thank you both for being here today, and especially the director, who I'm sure is pretty tired out by now, but appreciate you being here or seasoned after the grilling that you've gotten in the Budget Committee.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Lisa Schwartz, the director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and with me is...
Jason Eisdorfer, director of the utility program at the Public Utility Commission.
And together we will present Energy 101 for Oregon. First, we're going to look at the whole pie. This is energy use throughout the state, all sectors. Transportation accounts for a full third of our energy use in the state. Residential and industrial account each for about a quarter of our energy use, and the remainder is for commercial purposes. Energy is a significant economic driver in Oregon, as it is elsewhere in the world. Right here, we spend about $6.5 billion a year on energy annually, and that's not including the transportation portion. And our presentation today is largely not focused on the transportation sector. Instead, we'll be focusing on electricity and thermal uses from the natural gas sector primarily. Turning to electricity explicitly for the next several slides, about 40% of electricity consumed in Oregon is produced in state. And of that, most of that is from renewable resources, mainly hydropower. So here is a snapshot looking at our electricity resource mix for the period of time 2009 through 2011 to try to average out some of the changes that we see in resource mix from year to year. And you'll see here, so this is the consumption pie. This is of all of our consumption in Oregon. Here are the energy resources that it comes from. You'll see hydro accounts for about 40% of the electricity we consume in Oregon. Coal, about one-third of the pie. And the next biggest energy source is natural gas. And in this time period, 2009 to 2011, it was about 12% of our electricity consumed in Oregon was from natural gas. And this is a growing sector because natural gas prices have come down, and they are projected to stay lower for at least over the next 5-10 years. So we have two kinds of electric utilities. The first kind are the investor-owned or the privately held utilities. They account for about two-thirds of the electricity sold in the state, and they are regulated by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. We have three of them in the state: Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, and Idaho Power. And together, they account for about three-quarters of the customers. The second kind of utility we have are consumer-owned utilities. They account for about 29% of electricity sold in the state, and there are three kinds of consumer-owned utilities. We have the cooperatives, we have the municipal electric utilities, and the people's utility districts. And consumer-owned utilities are governed by their own boards, their own city councils, and they're not regulated by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And then finally, in 1999, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 1149 that provided choice of electricity supplier for all business customers of PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric. And the latest year for which we have statistics, 2011, compiled, 2.3% of Oregon sales were attributed to these alternative suppliers. So how does power get from a power plant all the way to your home?
We have a question, and I was going to say, if you do have a question during the slides, feel free to ask, because it's probably good while it's up there. It's Senator Hansel.
What's an example of electricity from an alternative provider? What would be an alternative provider?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, electricity service suppliers under Senate Bill 1149 are certified by the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and these are private companies that market electricity directly to the business customers in this state of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. And my colleague Jason Eisdorfer does not have anything additional to add.
Follow up.
Yeah, follow up. Give me an example of not what they are, but maybe who they are, for example. How would this...
Senator Hansel.
Jason, you need to state your name for the record.
This is Jason Eisdorfer, again, Director of the Utility Program at the Public Utility Commission. There are two energy service suppliers certified by the Public Utility Commission. One is Noble Energy, and the other is Iberdrola. So they're marketers who will go to directly to a industrial customer and serve them rather than going through the utility.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continue, and I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to move because we are ending at 4, and so you've got 46 minutes left.
So how do we get power from a power plant
ending
all the way?
Your part at 4, by the way, so we can get into some public hearings.
How do we get electricity from the power plant to homes and businesses? Well, it's produced whether it's a natural gas plant, what have you. The electricity voltage is stepped up through a transformer in order to run across high voltage transmission lines over long distances. As the electricity gets closer and closer to its intended point of delivery, it'll be stepped down first at a substation level and then ultimately at transformers so that it's serving at the proper voltage in a home or business. And it's important to note that we have three transmission interconnections in the United States. We have a western U.S. interconnection that also bleeds into parts of Canada and a little bit of Mexico. We have one that covers the entire eastern U.S. Plus parts of Canada. And then we also have Texas, which stands alone. And so while we can get power here in Oregon from as far as Arizona or from Alberta, we're not getting it, say, from Mississippi or Florida.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, we're going to switch off back and forth a little bit so that we can stay fresh. Lisa's given a very general introduction to electricity in Oregon. Now we're going to drill down a little bit. But no utility operates in isolation. Every utility has some regional connection, whether it's transmission or purchasing energy from across state lines, et cetera. And so we're going to start with three regional players. By far the biggest regional player is the Bonneville Power Administration. BPA is a federal power marketing administration. It is an arm of the United States Department of Energy, and it markets the energy generated by the federally owned dams on the Columbia River system, the dams owned by the U.S. Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation. Part of what they sell also is the output of the Columbia Generating Station, a nuclear plant in Washington State. There's some wind in their system, and there are some market purchases. But by far the most amount of energy that they do market is greenhouse gas emission free. I think a little bit later we're going to talk about one of the holy grails of energy innovation, which is going to be storage. A lot of interest in that. Well, the Pacific Northwest is a giant battery. There is water behind the dams, but really the big battery is snowpack in the mountains and the hills. It's that snowpack that melts and through the hydrology makes its way into the Columbia River system and through the dams. It is very low cost, zero greenhouse gas emitting energy. So the energy that is marketed by BPA, depending upon the water year, because the water year does vary quite significantly, is somewhere between a quarter and a third of the overall demand of the Pacific Northwest. You might know that Bill Drummond was recently appointed the administrator of BPA just at the beginning of February. Steve Wright stepped down after over 10 years. In addition to the output of the hydro system, BPA also owns and operates about three-quarters of the regional transmission system. It funds and oversees a fish and wildlife mitigation program to reduce the impacts on fish and wildlife as a result of the hydro system. And Bonneville operates the core energy efficiency programs for the consumer-owned utilities. BPA sells at cost, and it maintains both public and regional preference. The public preference, through decades of federal law, the consumer-owned utilities have preference to the output of BPA. Again, low cost, it's highly valued output. In 1980, Congress passed an important act, the Northwest Power Act. It's so important that some people just call it the 1980 Act. And that did a number of things. One of the things it did was to bring residential and small farm customers of the investor-owned utilities into the fold of the Bonneville program. Residential and small farm customers of IUs don't get actual output from BPA, but they do get essentially a rate credit, so they participate in the value of the system. Another thing that the 1980 Act was to create the Northwest Planning and Power Planning and Conservation Council. This is a regional compact. It consists of eight members appointed by the governors of the four Northwest states. And there are really sort of two parts of the council. One is the council itself with the eight members, and they make sort of the big policy calls. The other part of the council is the staff. It's a great staff. Not every region has something like the council. There's a lot of expertise and a lot of good thinking in there. The Power Act directs the council to develop a 20-year regional plan to assure the Northwest an adequate, efficient, and an economical power supply. When we get a little bit later into the presentation, we'll talk about integrated resource planning, something that the Public Utility Commission requires of the investor-owned utilities. This is sort of like an IRP for the region. It's not utility specific. It's very generic, but it goes along the same basic path. It looks at the risks that are out there. Fossil fuel price volatility, greenhouse gas potential risks, it looks at the load that needs to be served, and it tries to come up with the best series of resources to serve the Northwest. So here's a slide from the council itself. You can see here that there is a lot of energy efficiency. The green they call conservation. That also includes energy efficiency. It's a term that the council uses. And one of the points that the council makes is that looking at load growth of the Northwest over the next decade plus, nearly all of that load growth can be served through energy efficiency and renewable energy. And the third regional entity that we're going to talk about today is the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. So the NEA, as it's called, is a regional nonprofit. It is funded by BPA on behalf of the consumer-owned utilities, the Energy Trust on behalf of the Oregon investor-owned utilities, and then the investor-owned utilities from the other states. And it's looking at ways to transfer the market with an eye toward making the system more energy efficient. Everything from going up the supply chain, making sure that efficient products and appliances are at the Home Depot when you get there, but also doing some research into innovative kinds of energy efficient products. And this slide, before I turn it back over to Lisa, is just an example of the kinds of stakeholders that both Lisa and I see and work with every day. The first three bullets, the Citizens Utility Board, the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, and Northwest Industrial Gas Users are consumer advocates. Northwest Intermittent Power Producers, Independent Power Producer Advocacy Group. There's Renewable Northwest Project, Northwest Energy Coalition. So there's a wide variety. There are dozens more, but this is just a cross-section.
Thank you.
So how much electricity does a typical household in Oregon use? Well, it's about 1,000 kilowatt hours per month. And in terms of costs, the costs in Oregon for electricity are lower than the national averages. I know it's hard to read the text here, but for example, for residential consumers, the average cost in Oregon is about 10 cents a kilowatt hour compared to 12 cents per kilowatt hour. Those are figures from October 2012. You'll also notice on this table that the cost for residential customers is different than the cost for commercial customers and different from the cost for industrial customers, and that's largely because the cost to serve each of those different types of customers is different. In terms of where each type of utility gets their resources that serves Oregon customers, the investor-owned utilities truly have different resource mixes than consumer-owned utilities, which receive, as Jason mentioned, most of their power from the federal Bonneville Power Administration System. So here's a snapshot for the year 2010 of the electricity mix for the two largest utilities in the state. These are both investor-owned utilities. The chart on the left is Pacific Power. The chart on the right is Portland General Electric. You can see their resource mix is different from one another. Starting with Pacific Power, in the year 2010, about two-thirds of Pacific Power's electricity came from coal resources, and this is coal largely in Wyoming area. And then you'll also see that natural gas played about 16% in the year. That was the amount of electricity that came from natural gas in that year. And much smaller amounts of hydro than you'll be seeing in the next set of slides from the consumer-owned utilities. So 10% hydroelectric for PacifiCorp in the year 2010. And you can already see the green slice of the pie starting to grow larger in terms of the renewable resources above and beyond the hydro that we have coming in for both PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric. On the right, the chart for Pacific Power, they received about a third of their power from coal in the year 2010, about a third from hydropower, about a quarter of their power from natural gas, and 7% from renewables beyond hydro.
And Lisa, I'm assuming that's pre-Boardman shutting down.
Right. This is Senator Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. This is the actual electricity use in the year 2010, and the Boardman facility is still up and running.
So the pie will look quite different after Boardman shuts down. I'm assuming the natural gas will expand.
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, that's correct. Turning to the consumer-owned utilities, we have two charts here. On the left is in aggregate all of the consumer-owned utilities in Oregon. And on the right is Eugene Water and Electric Board as a specific example. Eugene Water and Electric Board is the third largest utility in the state, and they actually acquire some of their own resources above and beyond what Bonneville Power Administration provides them. So their resource mix is a little different. But you can see that they're very heavily blessed with having access to the federal hydropower system. In aggregate, in the year 2010, about three-quarters of the electricity from the consumer-owned utilities in the state came from hydro. They also have access to the Columbia Generating Station that Bonneville Power also markets power from. And then in terms of the other pieces of the pie on the left and on the right, where you see non-hydro and non-nuclear resources, so you see, for example, coal and natural gas, these are from the market purchases that Bonneville Power makes on behalf of its consumer-owned utilities. In the case of Eugene Water Electric Board, some of the market activity on its own, too, to serve its own customers. But the real story here is most of the resources are purchased from Bonneville and free of greenhouse gas emissions except for market purchases.
The slide here shows the rates of the 20 largest electric utilities in Oregon. You can see in the green The rates of the three investor-owned utilities in the state, and the blue are the consumer-owned utilities. And again, a lot of things go into making up a rate, but clearly one of the things here is access to Bonneville and the low-cost hydro has an impact on this slide. These are the three investor-owned utilities, electric utilities that serve Oregon customers and which are regulated by the Public Utility Commission. PGE is the largest electric utility in the state. Its service territory is in the North Willamette Valley around Portland and parts of Salem. It's headquartered in Salem, and it's a standalone publicly traded entity. PacifiCorp service territory is dispersed throughout the state. It's really throughout the state. There's a few spots on the coast, some southern Oregon, in the Bend area, in eastern Oregon. It is there, and in Portland, there are some North Portland. There are some parts that are served by PacifiCorp, but in general, they're disassociated from each other. Sometimes it's quite rural. It's ultimately owned by Berkshire Hathaway through the Mid-American Holding Company. And then, finally, Idaho Power is the smallest footprint in Oregon along the eastern edge of the state, and it's publicly traded as well. Again, there are a lot of things that go into making up rates. This is a trajectory over the last decade, 15 years, something like that. Relatively recent reasons for cost increases include increases in power costs, Distribution system investments, rate basing of generating resources, and pollution control investments on coal plants. Additional kind of drivers in the future will be caused by federal compliance requirements, investment in transmission facilities, et cetera. This is a pretty quick slide just to get our nomenclature right. Supply side is generating electricity. It is coal, gas, wind, geothermal, solar. It's if you are creating a kilowatt, it's supply side. Demand side is in my house. It's the energy efficiency. It's demand response. When there are some programs where a utility will ask an industrial customer, given a price signal to curb their energy use, and that's responsive to that signal. So it's demand side and supply side. Here we're introducing, again, the topic of the integrated resource planning. The Public Utility Commission requires both the electric and the natural gas investor-owned utilities to file IRPs. These are 20-year plans that look out. They take a look at the load in their surface territory as it stands today and it's going to grow over 20 years. They look at various risks and uncertainties, like a potential price on carbon, like fossil fuel volatility. And then they try to, through a bunch of scenarios and various computer runs, try to identify what the best least cost, least risk set of resources there would be to invest in to serve their public on the long run. So there's a 5-year action plan. And every 2 years, the utility has to do it again. So this is a sort of a classic example of what the IRP is trying to do. There's two things going on here. The red line edging upward is an example from an older PGE IRP. That red line is their load growing over time. that layer cake at the bottom is their set of existing resources. So as Senator Dinkfelder noticed, you can see at the bottom in the purple is the Boardman facility that is scheduled to close in 2020. The other resources will continue out, and the exercise in the IRP is how do you best fill that gap between the existing resources and the demand that's growing. But before we move away, I want to make sure that we're just understanding there's like we're going to start using megawatt hours and average megawatts, so I just want to take a minute to talk about this. And what's a megawatt? A megawatt is 1,000 times a kilowatt. A kilowatt is 1,000 times a watt. If you have 10 good old-fashioned 100-watt incandescent bulbs, you have and you turn them all on, you're burning at a kilowatt rate, and multiply that by 1,000, and you're at a megawatt. But that's a rate. That's like saying 60 miles an hour. It doesn't tell you how much you've used. So if you drive 60 miles an hour and you drive for an hour, you've gone 60 miles. So there's your megawatt hour I'm using or generating energy at the rate of a megawatt for an hour. And an average megawatt is a lot of energy. An average megawatt is that megawatt hour for every hour of the year. So that's 8,760 megawatt hours is an average megawatt. A industrial customer in Oregon can reach to 25 average megawatts. There are a few industrial customers in Oregon that are more than 25 average megawatts. The load of the city of Seattle is about 1,100 average megawatts. So when we're getting up into thousands of megawatts, average megawatts, we're talking about a lot of energy. And I sort of say that because this is another slide from the council. This is a resource curve, and what this is generally showing is the amount and cost of the kinds of resources that one could acquire in the order of least cost first. And so you'll notice that the first set of resources is going to be energy efficiency. Then there are gas and renewables, and then sort of on up the curve. And the point generally is to try to hug the left side as you're developing these resources. This is a little bit of an older slide. Gas prices have come down recently, so that would affect some of the points on this graph, but the general trend is the same.
So that's a good segue to this slide, which is looking at the cost of new generation in the United States. So this is from the U.S. Energy Information Administration from their July 2012 Energy Outlook. And it's taking a look at what it would cost if you wanted to put a power plant in service in the year 2017. And really, there are two, I think, key takeaways from this slide. First is the point Jason just mentioned. Natural gas prices have come down a lot, and they are continued projected to remain looking good for at least the next 5-10 years. So this natural gas price for an all-in cost for a power plant is down to now 6.6 cents per kilowatt hour, which is a pretty good price, and you can see it's really beating out most other things here. The other notable point on this slide is solar at 15 cents for utility scale grid connected per kilowatt hour. That's down quite a bit from just a couple years ago, mostly due to better manufacturing processes and more competition there and some other factors. So these figures do not include any federal incentives, any state incentives. So, for example, for solar, there's a 30% investment tax credit that's not included in these figures.
So quick question. I was just going to ask you that. When you do you be helpful to get the slide with the incentives to see how that levels the playing field, especially for solar? I mean, I'm curious how competitive, once we plug in all the incentives that we have now, how competitive solar is today.
Chair Dingfelder, we'll be happy to do that. So now we're going to turn to average emissions from power plants. These are real numbers. These are for the data year 2009 from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's eGrid, which is their system for providing information on emissions. So this is fairly new information. And I think, and this is for our region. This is for the Northwest Power Pool. And I really I just wanted to point out really two key takeaways here, two key takeaways. One is that for natural gas fire power plants, they've got half of the carbon dioxide. As coal-fired power plants, they've also got much less sulfur dioxide emissions. And also, of course, you notice that renewable resources, wind and solar, for example, hydroelectricity, we have no emissions from those.
And just a quick question on that to be asked. And we don't, like, these costs are not captured in anything right now, are they?
Chair Dingfelder, to the extent that emissions controls are required by law, I believe, and we'd be happy to confirm that and get back to you, I believe that those costs are baked in to, it would represent the type of plant that would have to be built in the year 2017 to be compliant. But any additional requirements, for example, on carbon dioxide that might be considered, you know, economic externalities today are not included in those prices. But to the extent that
if there's scrubbers or something in there, that would be included in that.
Chair Dingfelder, that's correct. If they're required to build a plant in the year 2017, that should be baked in.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Lisa, for your report so far. On your previous slide, you talked about geothermal. Do we have any geothermal facilities up and running?
One commercial, I just found out, right? Don't we have a new commercial one that just got started?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we do have some geothermal facilities. I'd be happy to get back with details because I think that is really interesting. I'm very interested in that resource because it's baseload power, which is very valuable, and we do have significant potential in the state of Oregon. So those were facilities located here in the state. But, of course, like we just discussed, we get power from all across the Western interconnection. So there are longstanding geothermal power plants at geysers in California, for example, and others that we're drawing power from. But I'd be happy to get back to you with more information on the
local. In the state of Oregon, we have the community solar, like in Klamath, that Dagami, who presented right before you, said that they got their application for their first commercial plant in southeast Oregon. So I don't know. I don't know if that means it's up and running or it's just they've just put in the permit for it.
So follow up.
Sorry to answer your question, but I just heard that.
That being the case, and you talk about the generation type of for carbon dioxide, et cetera, geothermal is not listed. Do they put out any toxics that we should be concerned about, such as sulfur dioxide?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, geothermal power plants do have some emissions on the sulfur side. We'd be happy to provide some information on that. But generally looking pretty good compared to a lot of alternatives.
Great. Thank you.
So we're going to talk for a couple of minutes about energy efficiency, which by definition, cost-effective energy efficiency is a least cost resource. And again, going back to that slide in your mind, it is the lowest cost resource and arguably the first one you go after. In Oregon, for the investor-owned utilities, the Energy Trust runs the programs. The consumer-owned utilities either run their own programs or use programs through the Bonneville Power Administration. The Energy Trust of Oregon is an independent nonprofit, and it is the energy efficiency acquirer for four investor-owned utilities in Oregon: PGE, Pacific Corp, Northwest Natural, and Cascade Natural Gas. The Energy Trust works with these four utilities in their IRP process to determine what the appropriate amount of energy efficiency acquisition would be in the least cost, least risk manner on behalf of those utility customers. The PUC has significant oversight over the Energy Trust to make sure that it produces those good results. There are yearly benchmark performance measures that the Energy Trust must meet. The grant agreement between the Energy Trust and the PUC describes what the Energy Trust's obligations are. There are annual and quarterly reports to the Public Utility Commission. One of the commissioners sits as an ex officio on the board of the Energy Trust. There's quite regular management coordination between the PUC and the ETO, and we're fully engaged and involved in the annual budgeting process of the Energy Trust.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I have a question on the ETO, if you would, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Can you answer questions for the ETO or about the ETO?
I can, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I can certainly answer the PUC relationship with the Energy
Trust.
Okay,
thank you. That would be in regard to that. The ETO gets their funding from fees that are put on electric bills. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
And as these electric bills increase, their fee increases along with it, or their rate of return goes along with that fee increase. So they're making more money per year. Do you look at the efficiency of that money and how that money is spent? Because my understanding is right now they're at about $300 million compared to just several years ago when they weren't quite that high.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, if rates are going up, that tends to mean that the value of energy efficiency also goes up as well, because your energy efficiency is going to be that least cost resource. And so that's something you're going to want to acquire anyway. The Energy Trust does what the utilities used to do. In the late 90s, one of the reasons that the Energy Trust came into being is the acquisition, the energy efficiency acquisition of the investor-owned utilities started to go down, and there are some inherent conflicts of interest with the investor-owned utilities wanting to sell more, not helping people save less. So it was sort of moved into a different nonprofit. But if the utilities were operating these programs now, they would be spending the same amount of money because the amount that is spent and what is acquired is based on the cost-effectiveness standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So here are the annual acquisitions of the Energy Trust since 2002. I should have brought my glasses. And we could have shown this as a cumulative, but there's a couple of important points here. One is that even though energy efficiency is the least cost resource, it still is sometimes hard to get. And you'll notice that in 2008, 2009, during the recession, the Energy Trust customers, you have to get into people's houses, and at that time with the economy as it was difficult to do that. I think arguably in 2010 and 11 and 12, people began to realize that one of the best investments you can make, even during a recession, is to reduce the amount of energy that you're using and paying for. So that really leaped up. Preliminary numbers showing in 2012 that the Energy Trust acquired 52 average megawatts, and that's short of stunning. That is an outstanding figure. That is a really significant amount of energy efficiency. I think we're pretty pleased with that result. So we're going to turn for a minute and talk about natural gas. Don't mean to make natural gas the second tier. They're just as important as the electric utilities are.
Jason, can I interrupt for a
yes.
minute? Senator Bates has
I'm
a question.
Sorry.
I thought that last slide, and this is something everybody else in the room probably knows. I'm new to this. For the Energy Trust, do you have a breakdown of where the money comes from, of commercial versus residential, and where the money goes out, commercial versus residential?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, I do. I just don't have it in my back pocket, so I'll have to get it to you.
I can take a look at that later with you if I could.
Absolutely.
I just want to see what it's coming from and where it's going to.
And, Senator, we've had presentations from the Energy Trust in the past, and we may try to get them in here and you know, fit it in, but I know that Jason can get that to you right away.
Thanks.
And, you know, it would be helpful, Jason. I was just thinking, why don't you send us the latest audit that you have. You send it to Beth, and she'll send it out to everybody, and probably a couple of the latest reports so folks have an example of the type of reporting that they have to do to the
Chair Dingfelder, I can send the committee the latest the annual report, the latest annual report.
Yep. Thank great.
Go back to gas,
sorry.
That's great. Natural gas utilities. The investor-owned natural gas utilities, the three top bullets, those are regulated by the Public Utility Commission, Northwest Natural Service Territories, largely in western Oregon, the Portland area. It's headquartered in Portland. Avista is mostly southwest Oregon and a little bit in the northeast. It's headquartered in Spokane. and Cascade is in Central Oregon and is a part of MDU Resources. The three gas transmission pipelines, not regulated by the PUC, these are interstate pipelines. We just put them on there so you could see the infrastructure. Storage is very important. MIST and Jackson Prairie are both geological storage facilities where the natural gas companies can inject natural gas into these storage facilities. It's very helpful from a consumer basis because you can buy low, inject, and then withdraw when market prices are higher. So there's a little bit of arbitrage going on over there. Northwest Natural also has some experience with liquefied natural gas, really as a storage alternative. The geological storage is significantly larger than the LNG. These, again, we saw the electric rates, similar kinds of dynamics going on with the natural gas rates. New infrastructure to be developed and put into rate base has an upward effect on rates. Although, let me come back for a second. Although I will say that, as Lisa said earlier, right now gas prices in the market are coming down. So these rates ought to tick down for a while at least, and then we'll see. No one can predict exactly where gas rates are going to go, but as of right now, gas is lower than it has been.
Question, please. Mm-hmm. Do any of your regulatory or your regulatory oversight, do they have any impact on the rate increases?
Senator, Chair Dinkfelder, Senator Olson, in what, to help me out with that, what do you mean by that?
If you pass rules to that, does that impact the rate? Does that upward pressure on rates of natural gas? Or rules or regulations that you might have?
Senator Olson, there, part of the rate structure includes the regulatory department of the utility. You know, to the extent that they are responding to new safety requirements, I suppose, yes, it would. I don't know that we've ever really tracked. I'm not sure exactly how we would track exactly the rules and regulations that the PUC would enact and the rate impact of it. I tend to think that looking at a rate case, the real drivers are the hard assets. The pipelines, customer information systems, that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
And just a quick follow-up, because I don't, there's no slide on here on pipeline safety, but I've spent a bit of time looking at pipeline safety, and that's not under your purview, is it? It's not the fire marshal?
There is a slide. Chair Dinkfelder, there is a slide a little bit late. Oh, is
okay.
That it?
Just two slides later.
We do. Reliability
purview?
Safety group and the PUC does look at, it makes sure that the utility trains its on-the-ground folks very well, occasionally goes out and inspects pipeline, and this goes for distribution lines as well. So that we do have a safety element as well.
Yeah, this is a big deal. Hopefully we won't be dealing with it the way Washington dealt with it a few years ago, but it's a big deal.
And I think we heard in Kansas City that just yesterday may have been caused by someone nicking a gas line.
We may want to, if we have time, maybe later in the session, we might do a little update on pipeline safety because it's a very important issue that we don't get a lot of information about. It's not talked about often until you have something that happens, and then everybody wants to know why aren't we doing everything we can to ensure pipeline safety.
Happy to come back. Again, this is the Energy Trust acquisition in terms of therms. You can see the same kind of little dip due to the recession, I think, in 2008 and 2009, and then a strong acquisition afterwards.
Okay, there we go.
This is another form of safety oversight that the Public Utility Commission has. It's the Utility Notification Center. It's the call before you dig concept that there's a number that you can call to make sure that where you're about to dig is not a gas pipeline or an underground distribution line. And subsequent to the beginning of this program, the number of incidents has been reduced really quite significantly.
Okay, so we just heard a bit about natural gas, so we're going to turn to renewable energy. And the renewable portfolio standard was put in place by the legislature in 2007. It's on the electricity side of the equation, and the aim was to stimulate the development of new renewable energy resources. So any type of facilities developed before 1995, including existing hydro, were not eligible. And since that time, there have been some changes to the law to include some existing biomass plants. Unlimited efficiency upgrades to hydro facilities are eligible, and up to statutory limits, also eligible under the hydro category, is low impact hydroelectricity. So the standard is for the largest utilities in the state, Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, and Eugene Water Electric Board, 25% renewable energy by the year 2025, with interim targets along the way. For all of the rest of the utilities in the state, the target is 5% by 2025, or 10% by that year, depending on their size.
Okay, you got 10 more minutes, so keep moving, and we probably will have a whole another session just talking about progress on our renewable portfolio standard in the future, so we'll be coming back and spending some more time on that.
Okay. The Oregon Department of Energy has certain statutory authorities under the law, primarily to certify the renewable generators for the renewable energy credit tracking system that's used west-wide. This is important to ensure that throughout the western U.S., whether a renewable energy credit is used for a mandatory program, such as a renewable portfolio standard, or a voluntary program, such as a green power program a utility may run to let customers choose to purchase more of their electricity from renewable resources, that those renewable energy credits are used once and only once. And so that's the west-wide tracking system we have at the Oregon Department of Energy. We certify facilities and make sure they're entered properly into that system for consumer protection. The Oregon Public Utility Commission has compliance authority over the investor-owned utilities as they meet the standard. This next topic, smart grid, is something that would require hours really to talk about.
Add hours of presentations here about it. So
right. So suffice it to say, I think that the easiest way to think about this is an interconnected system of information and community communications technologies that works with all of the technologies throughout the electricity system, all the way from power plants to transmission lines to the distribution system, all the way into our homes and businesses, that together can do some great things. It could help consumers manage their energy use and reduce their energy bills. It could increase system reliability through automation instead of having system operators manually performing many of these services. And it's got tremendous potential to improve integration of wind and solar with simple things just like automatic controls on our electric water heating systems. Compressed natural gas, this is really on the transportation side. Just wanted to point out that there are a lot of alternative fuel infrastructure projects that are happening in Oregon, whether it's electricity, natural gas, propane, what have you, biofuels, and this is just one of the examples. And the primary reason really is for cost savings and for emissions savings and also for environmental compliance. We see this primarily with large fleets.
Okay, so I am going to ask you two to stop there because we can read the rest of this. There's going to be some overlap, and I want to leave a few minutes for questions. As you said, we could spend hours just talking about the PUC, and we did just spend hours, I did anyway, we talked about ODO and your mission and goals and budget. So I will just ask for the lights to come up, and we'll see if there's a couple of quick questions before we move into our hearings and work sessions today. But I just want to say thank you for both of you coming on such short notice. This is a good start, especially for the new members, about all that's out there. I've been getting up to speed for 7 years, and I still feel like I have a lot to learn, even after a two-year energy training course. But there is a huge amount of information to cover in this issue area. So I want to see if there's a couple of last questions before we move on to our actual bills. And I'm sure that our members will pull you into their offices if they have additional information that they'd like as well. But if you can follow up with those reports we talked about, I'd appreciate that. And I'm sure we'll have you back up in front of this committee in just probably a matter of weeks.
I just want to say thank you. It's very, very informative, very helpful to me. Appreciate
sort of the flashcard version of energy. All right. Thank you both for coming here today. And we will move on to our regular scheduled hearings. And we're going to reverse the, because we do have some people who drove here to testify. We're going to probably reverse the order because we do have some, what I'm seeing is we do have some lobbyists who I know can come back if we need to, if we're going to run over. But I will start, then I will close the informational meeting on Energy 101. And we are going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 536. So I'm going to open a public hearing on 536, and Beth, if you can provide an overview on that.
Madam Chair and Committee Members, Senate Bill 536 authorizes a state agency by rule to implement a program to distribute, dispense, or otherwise make electricity available for use in motor vehicles, or to contract with vendors to distribute, dispense, or otherwise make electricity available for use in motor vehicles. It also extends the sunset for Oregon Department of Administrative Services program to make compressed natural gas available for use in motor vehicles until January 2nd, 2018.
Great. Thank you, Beth. We have a few people like to sign up who have signed up to testify, and I'm going to call up Lynn Peterson and Emmaline. Did I get that right? Emmaline? Emmaline. Why don't you come up and introduce yourself, and I will mention that this may be the last time that Lynn Peterson testifies in front of this committee in her current capacity, and congratulations, Lynn.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Peterson. I'm the Sustainable Communities and Transportation Advisor to Governor Kitzhaber. We just wanted to come and offer our support for Senate Bill 536. It authorizes the state agencies to write rules designated to make electricity available for use in motor vehicles. I'm losing my voice. The governor's 10-year energy action plan has several components, and one of them being transportation. Under that transportation component, one of the most important aspects of that is accelerating fleet turnover to alternative fuel vehicles. We are fuel neutral on that, but this bill really does help move us in that direction. One of the biggest challenges is facing the growing electric vehicle fleet is accessing electricity throughout the day, and meeting this challenge is especially difficult for state officials, its employees, and its customers. Thanks. Who use EVs. All too often, their meetings take place in buildings currently located inconvenient distances from existing charging stations. I must say, as a Leaf owner, I have gotten a lot of walking in. Senate Bill 536 is intended to address this challenge by authorizing state agencies to develop rules that would help us make creating this infrastructure a reality. And since you've all read it, I just want to make sure that we also allow the extension for the CNG facilities as well, and any other facilities such as propane, if so desired.
Okay. So I have a quick question. Thank you, Lynn. If somebody has an electric car, works for the state, what do they do now?
Currently, in any of our parking facilities, we don't have charging stations. The reason is that we have not authorized DAS or the facilities folks to actually allow for those charging stations to be put in there, because there was an issue about charging for the electricity. This would allow a third-party vendor who already does that to come in and deal with all of the charging, not only the literal charging infrastructure, but the cash charging infrastructure.
So, say I
right now they have to actually park downtown Salem And if you're in Salem, way over by Nordstrom's, and there's only two charging stations, so there's a little bit of competition. And over at the museum, the Mill Museum is actually the closest to the Capitol. And so, there's competition there as well.
And under this bill, if a bid goes out and a contractor comes in and puts in a charging station, then who would that be paid for, by the driver through a credit card, or they would
Correct.
Receive a bill every month, or how
Correct.
Would that be paid?
Most of these, Chair Dingfelder, these third-party folks install and then charge the user directly. So the
so
state
there would
not be
no cost to the state?
Correct.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
Madam
Other
Chair.
Questions for Lynn Peterson?
Yes.
This is her last chance to be
yeah.
grilled. So,
as,
you know.
As you well know, parking spaces are at a premium
mm-hmm.
around the state office buildings. Would we presume then that those with electric cars would have a beneficial resource to park? Or is this, can you just pull in there and charge and then you have to leave?
Chair Dingfelder and Vice Chair Olson, what they have been doing, these third-party contracting folks, they have actually started charging whether you're actually getting electricity or not. So they're charging for the parking as well. So there is a incentive to turn over in terms of the parking facilities.
You're not parking there all day.
Right.
And charging.
So you're getting charged $1 or $2, depending on your membership, per hour, whether you're charging or not, which is an incentive to move your car as quickly as possible.
That's a good question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Ms. Peterson? Why don't you stay up there, because there may be something mm-hmm. else that comes up.
Thank you
for coming to testify.
Thank you. My name is Emmeline Ponnell, and I'm the program manager at Drive Oregon. Drive Oregon is the nonprofit trade association whose mission is to support, grow, and build the electric vehicle industry here in the state. So on behalf of Drive Oregon, I would like to express our strong support of Senate Bill 536. I've also submitted some testimony from our member companies also in support of the bill. They unfortunately couldn't make it to Salem today. So I wanted to go over quickly a few reasons why we're supporting Senate Bill 536. Like Lynn was mentioning, this bill provides the value of charging at the state facilities, which is a benefit to employees who may own the vehicles, visitors who may be stopping by the state facilities and needing to charge, and also to further the fleet adoption of electric vehicles by different state agencies. So really, Senate Bill 536 is complementary to a lot of the different initiatives going on here in the state to speed up the deployment of EV charging stations and EV adoption. Secondly, the bill, how it's written, it provides a lot of flexibility to the state agencies in determining how they'll put them in and who they'll work with. As Lynn was mentioning, they do have the option of partnering with third-party charging station providers. And we think that out of those partnerships and collaborations, there could be some pretty neat projects developing in terms of how to most effectively do those payment transactions that Lynn also mentioned. So we're excited to see what could potentially come out of that. And, of course, highlighting that this is all at no cost to the state, that the system needs to be designed in a way where the private companies and the citizens who are actually using the stations will be the ones covering all of those costs, not Oregonian taxpayers who aren't plugging in. The last part that I want to highlight is the potential economic impacts of this bill. Right now we have over half a dozen private EV charging companies operating in the state. Some are based here and have kicked off their operations here in Oregon, or are companies from out of state who have come and opened offices knowing that Oregon is a leader in this EV field. To name a few companies, there's Clipper Creek and EV for Oregon, who both submitted testimony. There's also OpConnect, Aero Environment that does the electric highway project, Blink, also known as Ecotality. So this Senate Bill 536 will open up new business opportunities for them to go in and put in their stations. And in the process, they'll be hiring local electricians and purchasing local hardware, further bolstering economic activity here in Oregon. And then my last comment is a little broader. By encouraging the shift to electric vehicles away from conventional vehicles, that's supporting broadly the economy here in Oregon. A study down in California found that for every dollar that we shift from being spent on gasoline to electricity, actually contributes to 16 times more jobs in the state. And although a study like that hasn't been done here yet in Oregon, I think the results would be pretty similar. By keeping money here and not shipping it overseas, that's adding to jobs here. So thank you for the opportunity to present today, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Emmeline?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Emmeline, I apologize. I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Could you?
Sure. Sorry. It's Ponnell.
Ponnell?
Ponnell.
Well, Ms. Ponnell, you state in your testimony here that $6 billion a year for gasoline and diesel. I've heard numbers that in a recent newspaper article were $5 billion. Regardless, mm-hmm. It says that virtually all this money quickly leaves the state. Now, you must assume or you must know the fact that when that gasoline is brought in, it's brought in at a wholesale price.
Mm-hmm.
Our wholesalers get a portion of the profit as they distribute it down the line. Our truck drivers make the money to deliver it. The gas stations make a profit. So is your assumption that all $6 billion goes back out of our state?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, I believe that is what the statistic means and takes into consideration those different levels of economic activity, and that the $6 billion still is directly leaving the state. But I'm not 100% sure. I can check on that and get back to you.
Maybe Ms. Peterson can answer that question.
I believe that that is correct.
So perhaps you can get us a copy of the study and we can mm-hmm. take a look at it.
Could you please?
Sure.
That would because, be helpful. Because if $6 billion comes in, I don't think that $6 billion goes back out.
We'll take a look at that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Because I have one last one for Lynn. So, and I think everybody, many people probably know that Lynn Peterson is leaving the state of Oregon and going to work for the state of Washington as the Washington Department of Transportation Director. Is that going to be your official title?
Secretary.
Secretary. Madam Secretary. So congratulations on that. But the question I have for you is, how are you going to get your electric car charged on the way up to Olympia? Is there a charging station?
Yes,
midway?
I've already looked into that, Chair Dingfelder, the committee members. We obviously have almost completed the entire electric highway along the West Coast with our partners in both the BC province as well as the state of Washington and the state of California. So we almost have BC to Baja complete. So going north, there are 4 charging stations between here and Olympia, and I will memorize them.
Yeah, we wouldn't want the new secretary getting stranded
no.
on one of the highways in Washington.
Then I'd like to ask, how long does it take to charge your car, and how far can you go?
Very good questions, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson. It all depends.
on the wind?
Yes.
It depends on how much rain, how much wind, the temperature in terms of the range. But they say the Leaf goes around 100 miles on a charge, but that's at a pretty slow speed with a very nice warm battery. And I get down here from Lake Oswego with about 15 to 20% of my charge left.
You'll be sitting and doing some work at a charging station.
Yeah, and it takes about five hours to fully charge the battery once I'm down here.
So how long is it going to take you to drive your Leaf to Seattle?
Olympia.
Oh, Olympia.
Longer right, the capital. Than it would in a gas-powered or hybrid.
Maybe we'll have her come report back and tell us.
Does it have a radio?
Just give me time. it's like driving a mobile iPad.
Is it?
You should try it, yeah. That's
well,
awesome.
Let's bring her out here and give her a shot before you leave.
All right. Thank you very much, ladies. Appreciate
thank
your
you
testimony. We do have a couple of other people that would like to testify, and I think you're going to have to take Senator Olson out for a spin in your Leaf.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, we have Joe Esmond and Gary Bauer that signed up to testify. Come on up. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill that did not sign up?
Are you back in the corner, Senator?
Okay. Chris, come on up. We saw that you submitted testimony, so glad that you're here. You can come up. Glad you're here in person.
I got a chair for you. Here you go.
Okay. Joe, why don't you go ahead since you signed up first?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I am a business agent for the IBEW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon, representing 4,000 members in the Portland Metro and 1,000 in Southwest Washington. Our union has been involved with EVs since the very beginning of these conversations, but 4, 5, 6 years ago. We are proud owners of a Chevy Volt. We have 9 charging stations, level 2s, at our union facilities. We are just about to take commission of a fast charger. And Senator Olson, if I may, there are 3 levels of charging stations, of charges. One is in your house, about 8 hours. Another one's about 220, same outlet, say for your dryer. And that takes about 4 to 5 hours. And then you have the fast charge. It's like getting hit with paddles on your chest if you have a heart attack. It's about a half hour. So I believe Lynn Peterson will be okay as she heads north. We have, as I said, we've been very involved. Our members and our contractors, small businesses, have installed a lot of these stations at the city of Portland, Multnomah County, homes, wherever. We're in the electron business, and if there's electrons, we want to be there. So we're strong supporters of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Chris, do you want to go next? And we do have your written testimony in front of us, so I know you will summarize.
Be brief, yes. thank you, Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Chris Hager-Baumer. I am the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I just really wanted to very briefly say that we support this bill. When you think about the fact that there's this public infrastructure out there that could be used as well by the citizens of Oregon, and we as citizens of Oregon own that infrastructure, I just think it makes sense to open it up and allow it to be used by anyone who owns an EV or a CNG-fueled vehicle. And I think that actually, Senator Olson, the answer to your question, Oregon Department of Energy is the one that produces that figure, and the most recent one was $6 billion. And they're looking at, they take out the taxes that are paid, and then I'm not actually sure how they break out when you get to the specifics of how much is actually spent here in the state. Certainly some of it is at gas stations and so on, but there's another study that's been done that shows that for every dollar that you spend on petroleum, a very, very tiny amount actually is supportive of the retail level. So we can get you that information.
Thank you.
And then I just wanted to very briefly say that both CNG and EVs, since I'm here from an environmental group, have very positive environmental benefits. There are a lot of folks out there who worry that EVs, you know, if you look full life cycle, they're getting electricity. Where does that electricity come from? But studies show, well, number one, the tailpipe.
Well, we know now because we just had our Energy 101.
Yes. Oh, you did. Okay, excellent. And I think that it's around, they reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 60%. So, and then also, you've got that great thing about tailpipes having no emissions there in the cities or elsewhere where we've got, still air quality in Oregon, the problems with air quality in Oregon are largely driven by vehicles. So positive aspects on all ends.
Thank you, Chris. Gary, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Looking at the governor's 10-year energy plan, it calls for increased use of alternative fuels for transportation purposes. So I had a very brief conversation with the chair and vice chair and Ms. Peterson about possibly adding some more generic language for alternative fuels for transportation purposes to just give us a little broader options for people going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. So, yes, there has been a friendly amendment offered, and so we will go ahead and look at drafting that up and send that out to the committee members and see what they think. And we are not planning to move this bill today, so we do have some time. So any questions for the committee? Senator Hansel? For the panel from the committee.
Joe, my question is, does the car jump when you hit it with the fast charge?
No, okay. No, Senator, it doesn't.
All right.
Very quickly, Senator, U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander and our Senator Jeff Murphy have been big sponsors of these bills back in D.C. And
it's a business driven besides the environmental.
Good.
Thank you. Any other questions in this end of the dais? Right. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 536. And as you heard, there's a little more work to be done, and probably be seeing that in a week or so. We will go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 249. Beth, if you can provide us with the overview. And we have an intern that is going to come up and join us. Do you want to introduce yourself, Misty?
Sure, I certainly will. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Misty Freeman. I'm a legislative policy intern with Committee Services. I have information for you about Senate Bill 249. No revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact statement have been issued for the Dash 2 amendments. The bill clarifies the use of monies deposited into the Clean Diesel Engine Fund to be used exclusively for initiatives to reduce emissions from diesel engines. The Dash 2 amendment establishes that money deposited into the fund received from the federal government must be used to reduce emissions from diesel engines and are not subject to the provisions of statute outlining how grants and loans from the fund are spent.
Okay, thank you. We have two people signed up, Palmer Mason from DEQ and Randy Tucker from Metro. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Okay, nobody else has signed up. Hey, gentlemen, can you tell us what this bill, why we need this bill today? That's my question of the day. What problem is this trying to solve?
Or create.
Or create. Hopefully not.
Thank you, Senator.
Always the opposite. See, this is the optimist, half glass full. No.
Hopefully not create any. Let me, I'll start give you a brief overview. I'm Randy Tucker. I'm Metro's Legislative Affairs Manager. And I am the least likely guy to be leading off the testimony of this bill, but I ended up by a longer process sort of in the driver's seat, at least for the organizing role here. What you have from me is a letter that doesn't have any logo on the top because it's signed by a bunch of people from different organizations, which is really the important part of the letter, the back of the letter. I've been working since before the short session last year with the people that signed the letter and their organizations, and I'll just name them, the Oregon Trucking Associations, the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, OEC, and Northwest Natural, to develop this legislation, make sure it did what everyone wanted it to do, and to bring it forward. It's pretty simple. The problem, if I can articulate it properly, and Palmer will correct me if I'm wrong, the problem it's trying to solve is that there are federal dollars available from the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act to come to Oregon. But when they come to Oregon, they go into a fund that has restrictions associated with how the money can be spent that are tighter than the restrictions on the federal money itself. So what the intent of this bill is merely to allow the federal dollars to be spent in the way the federal government allows them to be spent and not to place any additional restrictions on them. And they will all be spent, they will all be spent for reducing diesel emissions in Oregon. And most recently, I think DEQ can explain this better than I can, but most recently we've been unable to find uses that are allowed by Oregon for this money. So we view this as a housekeeping measure to just make it possible to spend federal dollars effectively on protecting people's health in Oregon and protecting the environment. And that's why this diverse group of organizations has signed this letter. So I'll end there.
Palmer, why don't you go, and then we'll take questions.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason, Government Relations Manager with the Department of Environmental Quality. I want to echo what Randy said. We're here in support of Senate Bill 249, specifically the Dash 2 Amendment, for much the same reasons that he shared with you. The only funding really available right now to do clean diesel work in Oregon is the federal money. At one time, the legislature provided general funds, but that's no longer the case. So if we're going to make progress in this area, it would really be helpful to be able to use the money for a broader set of purposes. And specifically, the bill speaks to that by
proposing to change the state statute and allow us to use the money in a way that can be maximized and is consistent with the federal guidelines. Previously, what we spent the money on was the exhaust retrofits of diesel engines, and now there's much more interest in, because we have cleaner diesel engines, they're now made and sold more widely, there's more interest in, rather than an exhaust retrofit, of actually replacing vehicles with newer vehicles with the new, that have the new cleaner diesel engines in it. So this money would, or this bill, if it were approved by the legislature, would allow us to use those federal dollars for that type of purpose. And so we're very supportive. Diesel is one of those pollutants that does raise a number of health, public health issues. And so we were happy to see this coalition that Randy talked about come together and support this. And we'd like to say that we support it as well. So I'll stop there and take any questions.
Great, I could just add one sentence, Madam Chair. The, Metro's specific interest is related to our role with respect to the solid waste system of the Portland region, and we're interested in being able to retrofit or replace garbage and recycling trucks. And so that's why we got involved in the first place.
I was going to ask that, but thank you for reading my mind. So just quickly, the chart is very informative, and so there was discussion in the work group, and there was agreement on the uses of the funds, having the Oregon Clean Diesel Fund mirror the what's allowed under the federal, and it looks like the Oregon one was quite restrictive compared to the federal.
We did discuss, Madam Chair, if I may, we before the session began a few months ago, we had a conversation about, well, do we want to try to pursue broader, you know, more flexibility for the use of any Oregon dollars in the fund. As Palmer points out, there aren't any Oregon dollars, I guess, in the fund. And we decided that it was much simpler to just, at least right at this time, to focus on the federal dollars where there's a prospect.
And that was my last question.
Yeah.
Because I was assuming that
there might
there
be a reason
no
at some point.
Yeah. Money. Yeah, there was no money coming from the state at this point.
Right.
There have been in the past. Okay.
Right.
Questions for either of these gentlemen? Looks pretty straightforward. Okay. With that, anybody else like to testify on this bill? Seeing no takers, we will close the public hearing on item 249. We will open up our last public hearing before we go into work sessions. And I guess, are you staying up here for this? Or?
No.
Very good job. Thank
okay.
you very
Thank
much.
You.
You passed the test. Senator Olson didn't ask any questions.
Yeah. Palmer lucked out.
I know. I'm sure he'll have his chance. There'll be another chance, though, or two. And we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 321. Beth, you're on board.
Madam Chair and Committee Members, Senate Bill 321, for the record, has a revenue statement that was issued that's in your packet, as well as a no fiscal impact statement. It extends the sunset date from January 1st, 2014 to January 1st, 2020 for tax credits for renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities.
Okay, and I'm just going to say a few words before we have, actually, Tim McCabe, why don't you come up and I will do an intro. So Senator Haas and I, many years back, talked about the need to review tax credits on a regular basis. And up until recently, there was some tax credits had no sunsets, which meant that we were spending money through our tax credits and tax breaks without having full public scrutiny of this process. And so fortunately, that was remedied a couple years back. We have rolling sunsets now in all our tax expenditures, and what the process that has occurred since then is that the policy committees do an initial review, because we're the ones who have the policy expertise, and then we make a recommendation and move that bill over to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. Senator Haas, have I left anything out?
I think that's a pretty good summary.
Okay, thank you. And we also, for those who are on the committee previously, recall that we were asked to review these tax credits with a set of policy questions, and hopefully you all have those policy questions in front of you. And these have been provided to Business Oregon because these are the types of questions that we need to answer in order for us to assess the efficacy of these tax credits. And this worked quite well last time, and we're certainly hoping that you'll be able to answer these questions. And I'm assuming that that's what the sheet is right in front of us.
Correct.
Great. So thank you, Mr. McCabe.
Yeah.
Chair Dingfelder, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim McCabe. I'm Director of Business Oregon. And I don't know if you want me to go through all these answers. I think I've explained them in that handout. But what I would like to say in support of Senate Bill 321, I'd just like to recite some figures. I can provide these to you at a later date. We do this. We do what's called an environmental impact study, okay, of what this means to our economy as a whole. And I just want to clear up actuals. I want to use actual figures now of what Oregon's done with the manufacturing Betsy. So since its inception in 2007, Oregon has issued $112 million in manufacturing Betsy's. Okay, of those, and all the information I'm going to provide you right now is dated from 2007 to 2011, so these are actual figures. The Betsy's that have actually been used, the amount of that money that has actually been used in tax credits is $39,606,000.
About a third.
Pardon me? About a third.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. In this time, the industry has employed over 1,900 people in the highest recessionary period the state has ever experienced. This was actually a growth area during a recession. So during that time, the direct output effect that money was spent from 2007 to 2011 was $1.3 billion within the state. Labor income totaled $310,318,000, and the state personal income tax, these are actual dollars that the state took in, was $12 million. So I bring that out because it looks as though we invested $38 million because those are the actual credits that were taken. The state realized $12 million, but those are direct jobs. If you take into account the indirect and induced jobs, the state realized these are construction jobs to build the facilities. These are jobs that service the industry. You take into everything into account where our estimation is that the state realized $25,900,000 in personal income tax revenue during this same period as a direct result of these credits. So this program to me, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, has been one of the best programs in terms of job creation that the state has ever introduced, and I firmly and strongly support continuing it and extending the sunset date.
Thank you. What I'm going to ask, we are not going to be working this bill today because I think the members need time to read through the information, and I would ask you to follow up with an email with the statistics that you cited. I think that would be helpful in any accompanying materials that you have. This is, you know, I appreciate the succinctness here, but I think that would be helpful as well. Questions for Ms. McCabe? Senator Haas.
Thanks, and I'm supportive of this policy to give you the tools you need. It would be good to get that list, though, and the actual companies.
Yeah, the companies, thank you.
Sure.
With benefits.
You mentioned a few of them in here, but I think getting the whole list and the amounts.
And you administer this now, not the Energy Department. And I was just wondering if you could comment on whether that's working better and what that looks like, the actual handing out of the credits and if it's running better, worse, or you probably won't say worse. your assessment.
Senator Haas, Chair Dingfelder, it was the reason for moving the program over when Governor Kulongoski introduced it, it was part of a bigger package that included renewables and energy conservation. So there's really three different ones. But I was an advisor to the governor at the time and was always supportive of this. You know, the Department of Energy at the time didn't have the ability to market a program like this. That wasn't their area of expertise, but Business Oregon or the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department at the time, that was what they did, and it is what we do. So we always worked in close, very closely with the Department of Energy when it was administered by them, and it was just a natural to move it. It wasn't that it was not working or working over there. It was just, it was a better fit in our department. It was a credit that we could better administer, I felt. The way these are given, an application comes forth. It's submitted along with, depending on how large the Betsy being asked for is, it's up to $75,000 to apply to pay the expenses, because we hire third-party people to verify that their business plan and their technology is valid and has a future. And I'm proud to say that we're the only state. I can give you the list. The list of people that have received a manufacturing Betsy totals five. There's five companies that have received these. And are you all familiar with SolarWorld? It's in the paper quite often. They were the recipient of approximately $41 million. Sanyo Solar, which is here in Salem, received the second largest, which was $40 million. MEMC. But I'll give you all this information. My only point is, it's not this extensive list of companies. These are employers. And it's a very easy program to administer because our requirements are quite high in order to receive this. What you oftentimes don't see, you may have read the Business Journal 4 years ago when I said no to a Betsy, and it was costing a community 200 jobs. Well, the reason we said no, this company didn't have a business plan. So, and we've said actually no to more companies than we've said yes to, because this, to us, is a very, very valuable tool that we can't afford to lose if we're going to continue to create jobs. In the future, I think we have to look at this to be more inclusive and look at it and not limit it to a specific industry. There's many growth industries in Oregon that could benefit from this. Right now, we use the business expansion plan. You may have seen the announcement at Oracle yesterday. Very limited funds, but very, very effective because they're tied to job creation and wages. So I hope that answered your question, but it's a great program.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes, follow up.
I don't want to cross-pollinate environment with revenue issues, but I am on this tax credit committee where this bill will go. And one of the problems we struggle with is literally the issuance of these tax credits. Lots of people are under the impression that the $40 million in credits that go to SolarWorld is like $40 million off their taxes, and that's not the case. And those credits are sold at a discounted rate for these companies so they can get the cash. And sometimes those discounts are 80%, and so or somewhere in that neighborhood. And so 20% of that $40 million goes to an investor. And you know, when we're cutting schools and all this, that's not exactly who we want to be helping, is lower the tax bill. So I'm just wondering that from your perspective, is there any way to help with that issue and maybe not have such a discount or figure out a way? And again, this is a little bit out of your scope, but it's more of a revenue issue. But just wondering what you think of that problem, and is there any way to help with that? And are there any other amendments here that we should do as a policy committee on this that would improve this tax credit, streamline it, slim it down, make it more efficient?
Senator Hess, Chair Dingfelder, the members of the committee, I think we can better educate people on that. I think you have to look at the total picture. The pass-through program is what made it attractive, because the companies we were trying to attract into the state didn't have any tax liability. So the pass-through program, and typically a $20 million Betsy, well, it's more than typically, this is exactly what happened, would sell for approximately $13,500,000. Okay, so that was cash to a SolarWorld by someone who had a tax liability in this state. And then they would take that $20 million and it would be spaced out over 5 years. So it isn't like that $20 million went out the door ever. It never did. Only 20% of the $20 million in any given year went out. And that's where, when we say we issued 110 or 112 million in actual manufacturing Betsy's dating back to 2007, only 39 million have actually been used. Okay, so what the point I'm making is, during that time, while they're using that, all these jobs that are being created and required in order to get that Betsy are creating revenue for the state. So it truly isn't, that's not $20 million going out the door. It's some smaller percentage of that amount. So these jobs that are being created are going back to the general fund.
So in the interest of time, I'm going to see if there's any other quick questions, because we are getting into the revenue end versus the policy aspect here, and we are going to be taking a look at this and coming back through for discussions in a work session.
I do have, Senator, do you have a question?
Well, it's a revenue question.
Okay, so.
I got a revenue question.
Ms. McCabe, thank you very much, and the Betsy is an important, as you say, tool. I hate when people use that word, but it's important to our state. But in light of the documentation and the notoriety of some of our renewable companies having business difficulties, when you look at these, do you prescribe more scrutiny to these companies to make certain that their business plan is not a short-term 5-year or more like a 20-year plan? Because some of these companies are not meeting the levels that they thought they would meet. And I just wondered how you, in your review of these, look at that and see if they are qualified.
Vice Chair Olson, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. As I stated, we when they first come to us, we use third party that are experts in the industry. One company we use, we have three companies actually, Turner Townsend out of Munich, Germany, industry experts. When they give us their business plan, the company, such as Solar World did, and this is the oldest one, an established industry expert. I mean, Solar World was the largest at the time. We look very closely at everything we do, at what they did, because it isn't a given because they're Solar World. We couldn't predict the future. Oregon was I won't say banking on this. It looked like a great opportunity. The solar industry was growing as the wind energy had done in the past. We still firmly believe there's going to be a future for the solar world, for the solar industry. What it's going to look like 2 years from now remains to be seen. I think what you see and what you read about are the ones that now are having some problems, but you don't see anything about Sanyo. They're double what they said they were going to be. So I think when you look at the overall picture, I still think there's an opportunity, but in answer to your question, we very closely scrutinize all of this to the best of our ability and use, as I said, third party. And I will say this, we're the only state that everyone we've given an incentive to is still here and still operating. You know, you read about Solyndra, you read about Evergreen and all of these in other states where they went. They came to us. They're not here. And there's a reason. One of them stated it's too hard to do business in Oregon. You know, and I will give you an example. I will use Evergreen because they say we courted them. We did not court Evergreen. Evergreen came to Oregon. We knew they were trying to leverage Oregon to get a better, and I'm sorry, this is the way it works. They wanted, they were in Massachusetts. We knew that's where they wanted to stay. We put the bare minimum on the table because, you know, and we said, okay, you want a Betsy, you're going to have to put in an application, which they did, but we never approved a Betsy for them.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. McCabe. We will look forward to the information. We probably will have you come back for the work session where we'll have my sense of additional questions. So appreciate, I know this was not, you were handed, for those of us who have been working on the Betsy for a long time, you were handed a big job, and we appreciate the work that you've done to tighten this program up.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have two people that like to testify on this. Joel Fisher, come up, please. And Jody Weiser, and I will tell you, I'm going to ask you if you've written testimony. Please summarize, because we have running short on time. We have some work sessions we're going to be doing. Joel, let me get started.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher. I'm the senior policy analyst at the Oregon Business Association, although I'm not actually senior to anybody there.
Is that right, junior on here?
Yeah.
Kind of like me.
So we're here to testify on Senate Bill 321. OBA has a pretty high bar for the tax credits that they support. They're going to focus on tax credits that directly have to do with business and support the following: have a well-defined purpose, include mechanisms to objectively evaluate whether the purpose has been achieved, not be excessively burdensome on government or participants, and promote one or more of the following goals: encourage innovation or intellectual property, cultivate Oregon's leadership position in an environmental quality and clean technology, support traded sector job growth, grow Oregon's per capita income. Stating with all these basically bars that need to be met, the OBA is only supporting 3 tax credits this session, and at the top of that list is the manufacturing energy tax credit, and so we urge your support.
Thank you, Joel. Hi, Jody. How are you?
Good. For the record, Jody Wisey with Tax Fairness Oregon. It's nice to be in front of this committee. It's been quite a long time. So the manufacturing Betsy is structured as a marketable tax credit, and I believe they're actually sold at auction now at only where people are bidding at 95% and above, but that's a fairly new program. And so the cost has gone from a discount of as much as you're getting 37 cents on the dollar to getting 95 cents on the dollar. And some people have even bid more than a dollar, but nobody's really explored why that is so. And businesses are currently eligible for repeated hunks of $20 million. I asked for and got a spreadsheet that included some of the $113 million that was mentioned, and I've put it on the paper that you have. Solarix got one tax credit in 2007. Solar World has come back on 4 different occasions and over just 2 years and gotten hunks of money. Sanyo Solar got $20 million, and Solar Power so far has gotten 20. That was just in the paper last week. Well, the actual use, so we pass them out, we commit to these, but they're used, and they will be used over 13 years. So part of the reason only $39 million has been used so far is that Solar Power just got theirs. They haven't started using theirs yet. And they will be using them over a 5-year period of time. There are at least 10 additional outstanding manufacturing Betsy tax credits, I believe, probably more, but the last time we got records was when the program was still at the Department of Energy. All we got was a spreadsheet that gave the first 3 on that list, and in fact, MEMC was mentioned today, but that didn't come on the list, nor did Solar Power. And it is absolutely certain that the manufacturing Betsy is why Oregon is known as one of the leading states for renewable energy. There's no doubt about it. We got not just manufacturers here, but we got some headquarters here, and it's partly because we were spending money to get them to come. However, we think that it's time for change. The solar cluster is well built, just as we don't need to be passing out hunks of $20 million to the athletic shoe industry. It's time to ask ourselves, do we need to be passing out hunks of $20 million to the solar industry, or is that cluster complete enough that we should move on and try to diversify so that we don't end up with an economy that is too focused in some areas? So we would amend 321 to exclude both solar and wind manufacturing. They're both mature industries now. The cost has come down a lot, and it'll continue to come down. In fact, in California, solar is as cheap as natural gas. They've got more expensive energy there, so that's a big difference between them and us. And they've got better sun than we do. Yes, it does.
Except for the eastern part of the state.
We would also suggest that you change the subsidy so it's towards the creation of jobs rather than towards capital investment, because most of the machinery that goes into these businesses, it's not made here. It's not really doing something for our economy that expensive equipment is put in. And, of course, the more equipment there is, the fewer jobs there are. And obviously, it's what they need to do, and we're giving them a tax break on the equipment in their property taxes. And so we don't really need to do it with this kind of thing instead. And so we should be saying, how many jobs are you bringing? And if you're going to retain those jobs, if you do retain those jobs for 5 years, we'll give you the value of the taxes of your employees, the new employees that you bring to the state for 2 years' worth of taxes. That's a subsidy that clearly would pay for itself. Some of these others, we've paid as much as $1 million a job with some of the wind farms and stuff, and you know that's not going to ever be recouped. And it wasn't really the purpose at the time, but now the industry is mature, and so if we're going to help them, it should be job-related rather than building the cluster-related. If you do choose to continue with a capital investment subsidy model, we would reduce the subsidy to 30% of capital investment or some other smaller figure than 50% of the first $40 million of investment. And allow a business to get one every 6 years, not three in 2 years. Require an equity position if we're putting a whole lot of money in. You know, if companies want to come here, and we're going to give them that kind of money. There's no other investor that gives money away like that except states and the U.S. government. And people who invest in private equity, they get a return that's more than jobs. They get profit. And so we could do that as well and ask that the shares be put in PERS, which would, of course, benefit the institutions of the government in the long term. And that would be a good place to put ownership. Also, in some cases, we've been giving loans and Betsy's to the same businesses. So it's putting us at additional risk for those businesses, and it would seem that we could do one or the other for a business, but when we do both, we're assuming a lot of risk, and that's not particularly prudent to do, and so that would be another change. And there are three different Betsy bills, Betsy manufacturing bills, in the building today. Of the three, House Bill 2224 is the best because the others extend the sunset to 2020, and that means it'll come in like this time in a cycle of tax credits for individuals and nonprofits rather than for businesses. The business group comes in 2018. The renewable energy effort really has largely succeeded in Oregon. We're known as a leading state. But now it's probably time to move on. And I just suggested, because I asked my own investment advisor, what if we were doing something for the financial cluster? And how many personnel you have and what's your payroll? And its payroll is $104,000 per employee. And so that would be a cluster where we could get high-wage jobs. And I don't know what they would need, but I don't think we're asking that question.
So, Jody, since we're running out of time, and you have very thorough testimony, which I do appreciate because you have done your homework as usual. So what I think we're going to do, we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to be I'm going to ask everybody to do their homework and read through this. And I'm going to be asking the committee members for recommendations, and then we'll have some discussions during the work session. Yeah, the question I also need to find out is how much we're going to be doing in this committee versus in the Joint Tax Credit Committee. And since we have a member here, I'll be having conversations with him. But I think you have some interesting ideas that I'd like everybody to mull over and appreciate the hard work that you put into this.
Thank you.
So with that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 321. We're done with our public hearing scheduled today. You all have, we have several work sessions in front of us, so we're going to try to still get you out of here on time. And with that, we will start with, we have one committee introduction, and this is for the appliance standards one. So, Beth, I'm going to have to open up a work session on introduction and committee measures.
Madam Chair and committee members, LC-2186 in front of you establishes a minimum energy efficiency standards for certain products.
Okay, and just a reminder that this is for the purposes of bill of introduction for consideration by the committee only. This is not a position on the bill, and the bill is, I think we've talked about in here this is the fourth time actually appliance standards have been before this body since I've been here. So with that, I would take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move that LC 2186 dated 2/18/2013 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Olson moves that LC 2186 dated 2/18/2013 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. We'll close the work session on introduction of committee measures, and we will go ahead and move on to opening up a work session on Senate Bill 116. Beth? Mm-hmm. This is just a reminder, this is the creating shipping transport of aquatic invasive species in Palmer. Palmer here still?
May
I guess
have
we
left.
Lost him. Okay, so.
Madam Chair, committee members, I would have to say that fiscal came in during the meeting, so I think Palmer may not know that it's already back. So so the dash 2 amendment that you have in front of you, I can explain. There was a conversation about the sunset in committee, and this dash 2 amendment extends that sunset to January 2nd, 2017, and authorizes the task force to submit additional reports as appropriate. This does have a subsequent referral to the committee on Ways and Means. There was a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact statement issued on the dash 2 amendment.
Okay, great, thank you. So I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 116.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 116. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
You waiting for me?
Yes.
You're supposed to get, oh, you did gavel.
Yes.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 116 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference, and it would be Senate Bill 116-2.
Great, thank you. Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 116 as amended with the dash 2s to the floor with the due pass recommendation and further referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. The bill is sent as amended to Ways and Means, and there will be no carrier because it will be carried by somebody in Ways and Means, possibly. I guess Senator Hansel is the only Ways and Means member here, so he will be able to explain that bill. Okay, moving on, we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 199, and I'm going to ask Tom Paul to come up and talk about the amendment. Beth, why don't you remind us what is in front of us?
Committee member, Senate Bill 199, you have the dash 12 amendment in front of you. For the record, has a no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact statement on the amendment itself. And I think Tom Paul is going to go into more detail, so I'll save your time
for that. And if you recall, committee members, there was discussion at the last public hearing on this, and Senator Olson, my vice chair, and I convened a mini work group. We locked people in my office and threw away the key, and this is what came out, a couple of different versions. But I do want to thank my vice chair, who has worked very hard on this, and appreciate his input. And I think we have a better bill in front of us. I think we have the Water Resources Department is going to explain what the dash 12 amendments do.
Okay. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Paul, Water Resources Department. Thank you for this opportunity, and because of the hour, I'll go quickly through this. In Section 1, Subsection 1, the original language from the statute is placed back in the bill, so there aren't deletions there. Additionally, Section 1, or Subsection 1, clarifies that except as provided in subsections 2 through 6 of Section 1, transfers of water rights in stream will go through the water right transfer process, which is currently in statute. In the remainder of Section 1, subsections 2 through 6, they relate to temporary change of a water right to in stream, and that's referred to as a lease. And in those subsections, it talks about a 5-year maximum term of a lease. It requires the department to provide notice of an application for a lease. There's also a requirement that the department determine that no injury will occur. In the event injury is determined after the lease has been approved, there are provisions that the lease can either be revoked or modified to eliminate the injury. Subsection And there are also talks about a split season lease, and that's a very specific type of lease where use can be used both for the authorized purpose during one part and then leased in stream during the other. Then in Section 2, it talks about a sunset, and there is a sunset in the bill that relates specifically to the split season portion. The sunset would also retain, or the sunset wording would retain all of the provisions that apply to the regular leases, such as the notice, the five-year limit, the injury review, and the ability to revoke if injury is determined.
Okay. Any questions for the department while we're up here, clarifications?
Senator? I have one. Yeah. Mr. Paul, I want to thank you and everybody that worked on these amendments to get this to where it'll be good for the folks of Oregon.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, I thank you also for the effort that you had. You were in the room before the door got locked and were able to escape. Chair Dingfelder, thank you for dedicating a part of your anniversary to that effort as well.
I can't think of better people to spend my wedding anniversary with than everybody in that room. But anyway, there's a little chuckling going on there. Any other questions on a more serious note on the substance of this amendment? Okay. All right. Thank you. With that, we are in a work session, correct? So I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the -12 amendments to Senate Bill 199.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the -12 amendments to Senate Bill 199. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, it is late, and you can tell I'm tired. Seeing none, that was me because I'm so tired. The amendment is adopted. I'll take another motion.
Chair Dinkfelder, I move that Senate Bill 199 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Senator Olson moves that Senate Bill 199 as amended with the -12s be reported out of the committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I would just like to thank my vice chair for working hard, assiduously on this bill because it was not an easy process, but it only took 12 amendments and we got there. So I appreciate your hard work. Any other discussion? Okay, can the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
Aye.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Aye. That the motion passes. And Senator Hansel had offered to carry the bill, and since he is the newest member, and this is probably going to be one of the most difficult bills to explain, we thought we would give him the honor, and we'll be there to back you up just in case. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 199. We have one more work session, and this is on Senate Bill. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 249. We just heard that with the -2 amendments.
Madam Chair, committee members, just for the record, the -2 amendment has a no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, I will accept a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 249.
Okay, Senator Olson moves to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 249. Is there any discussion? Okay, any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. The amendment is adopted.
Chair Dingfelder, I move that Senate Bill 249 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Olson moves that Senate Bill 249 as amended by the -2s come out of the committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, why don't we have the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
Aye.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Olson? Aye.
Chair
Dingfelder? Aye. That motion passes. Do we have a volunteer who would like to carry this bill? Senator Haas. Excellent. Okay. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 49. And I have one more announcement, which is... Oh, right. We have one more work session. I'm sorry. It's a good thing Beth is here to keep me on the straight and narrow. So we have a bill that was assigned to our committee, but we are not going to hear it in this committee because it is a revenue bill. It has to do with convening a work group to investigate and develop strategies, recommend strategies to impose a carbon tax. And so we have been requested to send that to the Revenue Committee. And this is basically, we're going to send it back to the Senate President, and then he makes the referrals. So are you okay making the motion? Or
sure.
Okay.
That's good. Chair Dingfelder, I move Senate Bill 537 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee.
Okay, Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 537 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes. And Beth, anything else that I've forgotten to do?
No, you accomplished your very
okay. At 1 minute before 5, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.